Next, the first flight of Space Shuttle Columbia.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
If the truth were known, we really delayed this launch so we could get the burritos on time.
I figured that.
The flight director says get back in.
We lost the flight plan out the window.
On all three networks, you replaced all the kitty cartoons.
Houston, we've had a problem.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I was rolling on the moon one day.
Counter, go and throttle up.
Counter, go and throttle up.
The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
You're listening to The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.
The first flight of Columbia. This is Rich Kirshner reporting. The space shuttle program began. Space Shuttle Columbia was the first orbiter in America's space shuttle fleet. Two astronauts were aboard. The commander was John Young, a veteran of four space flights previously, and the rookie on the flight, pilot Robert Crippen. This would be a two-day space mission. It would prove that the shuttle could launch, orbit the Earth, perform minor tasks, and land like an airplane on a runway. Columbia blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on April the 12th, 1981. This mission will be narrated by John Young and Robert Crippen after their spaceflight had ended.
We brought our own version of our home movies that we would like to roll for you here and tell you from our standpoint what the first mission was like. Could we go ahead and roll the film, please? They told me that would work. All I had to do was say it, and it would happen.
This is Bob suiting up in a suit room, and this is me suiting up, and you can see we both got a ring around the collar in a big way. That's a standard off-the-shelf ejection seat. You see those two big flags on the shoulders? That was my big project for the week before flight. I had to insist that we put on big United States flags. People in Washington told me it didn't match with a small NASA patch on the shoulder, and I had to point out the United States was bigger than NASA. It was a tough battle, too, I want to tell you.
This shows us going out through the white room that we used to gain access to the Columbia, and you'll notice all the technicians wearing those little masks. That's part of the health stabilization program that we undergo just prior to launch, and I can assure you that we didn't make anybody sick the entire time we were at the Kennedy Space Center.
When they close the door, everybody runs off and leaves us up there, and it's only me and Crippen. It gets kind of lonely out there.
Our countryman and poet, William Cullen Bryant, once said, "America is where mankind throws off its last fetters. With your exploits, we loosen one more. Who, he said, shall place a limit to the giant's strength or curb his swiftness in the forward race? Through you today, we all feel as giants once again. Once again, we feel the surge of pride that comes from knowing we are the first and we are the best. And we are so because we are free. For all Americans, Nancy and I thank you and the thousands of others who have worked to make this day possible. As you hurtle from Earth in a craft unlike any other ever constructed, you will do so in a feat of American technology and American will. May God bless you, and may God bring you safely home to us again." That's the end of the message. And John, we can't do more from the launch team than say we sure wish you an awful lot of luck. We're with you 1,000%, and we're awful proud to have been a part of it. Good luck, John.
Trip and I are mighty proud to work with you, fellas. You're absolutely professional. The best there is. And that's a mighty fine speech, and we sure appreciate it.
Okay, this NTD on 212, I'd like the verification.
That was shuttle launch control. Our launch director, George Page, reading a message from President Reagan to the Columbia crew. Chuck Cannon had just said, "Smooth sailing, baby," to astronauts John Young and Bob Crippen. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4.
This is a slow motion film of the high technology liquid hydrogen oxygen engines lighting off. They're the lightest and have the most thrust of any rocket engines ever built.
We've gone for main engine start. We have main engine start. Shuttle has cleared the tower.
As the engines light off the nose of that tank, you can see from the shadow rocks forward and rocks back. Then the solid rocket bolts blow and the solid rocket motors ignite simultaneously. Again, this is slow motion film. And the vehicle will slowly rise out of its hole in this picture, but it rises out really fast when you're sitting on top of it.
Actually, we got a little bang in the cockpit when the mains lit off and another one when the solids lit off, and there was some shaking in the cockpit, but it quickly damped out. By the time we cleared the tower, it was all gone. You notice how close we come up to that inner access arm on the gantry there. We got the engineers looking at that. Maybe it's a little bit too close. But at the point we cleared the tower, the vehicle was like a, if you were to imagine it being a very fast elevator going up. It wasn't a big kick in the pants like lots of us had thought it might be. It was a very smooth ride. This shows the roll program, which points the tail of the vehicle out over the Atlantic Ocean. We set quite a bit above the center of gravity. We anticipated that that was going to cause quite a bit of lurching in the cockpit, but it didn't. This shows the out the window view that we had on board. Those clouds you see aren't really clouds. They're contrails generated by our weather airplane that was actually creating more weather than it found.
This is a vehicle going out. It's almost going straight up right now. And going straight up, it's a very heavy vehicle, yet it's going supersonic right now, exceeding the sound barrier. The vibration increased slightly in the cockpit as we went supersonic. However, the noise was such that we could still talk to each other very comfortably. You can see the back of the tank glowing white hot from the heat from the solid rocket motors. And you can see how clear the liquid hydrogen oxygen engine is burning on those three main engines as we go out to accelerate and supersonic up to staging.
Roger, Columbia on the nice ride. You're lofting a little bit, so it could probably be slightly high at staging.
1 minute, 45 seconds coming up on go.
Columbia, you're negative seat.
That call up says Columbia, the altitude is too high for ejection seat use.
You notice this big long flame and fire and how it's several times as long as the orbiter itself and several times as wide. John and I were both thankful we didn't have a rear view mirror in the cockpit because that might have scared us a little bit. But the thing that you can't gain from looking at that is how smooth the ride was. Max acceleration we got was like three times what you're experiencing now. That took us up to 170,000 feet on those solid rockets, at which time the solids had expended all of their fuel and they were jettisoned off.
Columbia, your go for SRB step.
2 minutes, 4 seconds, standing by for SRB SEP confirmation.
This shows the left solid coming off at this time, and both of them trailed off perfectly together. In other words, there wasn't any yaw motion. You will see that flash out the window, and that's the only exterior evidence that we had actually SEP'd. There was no jerking, no motion in the cockpit. It was a very nice ride.
Roger on the SEP, Columbia.
Mark, 2 minutes, 20 seconds. Confirm solid rocket booster SEP.
These are big 90-ton motor cases, and they're kicked back up and over the wing, and they come back off, go up to 275,000 feet, come down at Mach 4.4 Mach number, and they open parachutes on them. We recover them and reuse them. We've recovered these. We're going to fill them up again and reuse them, but Crip and I haven't volunteered for that mission.
Standing by now for main engine cutoff.
25670
up at 220
feet
per second.
Roger, Columbia, Miko.
Confirm shutdown. Columbia, the gem of this new ocean, now in space, not yet in orbit.
We were getting some debris coming off our external tank, that big gas tank that fuels the main engines. Appeared to be some insulation material that we use on the tank itself, and some of the engineers are looking at that.
Now standing by now for external tank separation.
Okay, we've had SEP.
Roger, we confirm the SEP, Columbia.
9 minutes, 3 seconds. Confirm external tank separation.
This shows those white particles is ice as we jettison that external tank, which is the only portion of the vehicle that is not reusable. That is jettisoned into the Indian Ocean.
Columbia now performing an evasive maneuver.
moving below and beyond and translating the north of the external tank. Young should see it moving away out his window.
The back of the tank, as you can see on the back end, was charred by that heat, but there's charring on the forward part of the tank, and that's due to aerodynamic heating. The air was rushing so fast over the tank. And then a little further up at the forward attach point, that tripod device up there is also aerodynamic heating. And on the nose of the tank was aerodynamic heating. When Bob and I first saw these pictures, it looked like the tank been in a small war. And the engineer said, oh, we knew all that. Oh, I wish they'd told us.
Actually, John and I couldn't see the tank itself while we were in orbit, and we had to wait till we got back and saw those films.
9 minutes, 40 seconds, go, no, go, status check, and mission control for the first Ohms burn. Given a go.
Columbia, Houston, your go for nominal Ohms 1, and for APU shutdown on time.
We went ahead and performed two maneuvers with our orbital maneuvering system, small rocket engines that we have, to establish our orbit. Initially, we established it at 130 miles.
Columbia now maneuvering to its Ohms 1 burn attitude. Using the two 6,000-pound thrust engines, Ohms 1 will be posi-grade, moving Columbia forward and higher on her flight path, placing Columbia in orbit.
And then we started to get out of our seats. As was mentioned earlier, we do have an ejection capability that is good up to about 100,000 feet and about Mach 3. And those suits that we're wearing, unlike previous manned space flights, are not designed to go outside the vehicle. Those are standard Air Force suits that, if we had to eject at high altitude, would allow us to get down to the ground safely. We have other suits available to us on board that allow us to go outside. You notice me tucking away my helmet. That weighed about 12, 13 pounds. And forever in simulations, I was always knocking against switches, hitting hand controllers and what have you with it. And one of the things nice about the zero-G in gravity, it basically just floats out of your road. Those suits themselves were very difficult to work in 1G, but up in zero-G, they're a delight. We got out of the seats, went back, and opened up the large payload bay doors that expose this cargo area that I was talking about.
The doors are all opened up and hunky-dory. We're now ready to proceed with RAD deployment.
Roger.
Shuttle Control, Houston. We show both payload bay doors open.
They are large doors. As I mentioned a while ago, they're 60 feet long. And it was opening of the right door that I initially saw back on the rear end of the spacecraft that we had a few of our tiles, our thermal protection system on board the orbiter, were missing.
Okay, we want to show you a home spot here. We do have a few tiles missing off of both of them, off of the starboard pod. It's got basically what looks appears to be three tiles and some smaller pieces, and off the port pod. Looks like I see one a full square, and looks like a few little triangular shapes that are missing, and we're trying to put that on TV right now.
Roger, Griff, we can see that good.
When we opened up the other door, we discovered the other side had a similar area of missing tiles, but we inspected our vertical stabilizer, the tail portion of the spacecraft, and we could also see the top of the wings, and all of those were in good shape. Now, those were the areas that really needed the tiles, and the pods themselves, these Ohms pods that we have back in the back where the tiles were missing, the heating is not that critical, and we weren't really worried about it. This pan shot shows that large cargo bay area. It only contained instrumentation on the first flight. That's the one that's going to contain future experiments and satellites that we'll be carrying up. This shows us floating around in the rear of the flight deck. One of the things we had helped illustrate to our management was that what we'd been saying all along, all those wires that we use for communication was like working in a spaghetti factory, and that it'd be nice if we had some wireless mics, which are going to fly on the second flight. This shot is down in our mid-deck. You can see we've got quite a bit of room, especially with only two people aboard, and it sort of illustrates what a delight zero-G is to be able to float around in that. Kind of opens up the whole volume that you have aboard. You do not need any special handholds, restraints. You can take advantage of what you have available to you, and it's simply a delight to work in. Here shows John putting his best foot or something forward there. It is a super environment that frees you up, and I, being a rookie on the first flight, it was really a joy for me to get a chance to work into that. This illustrates what I was saying about restraints and changing out one of the lithium hydroxide canisters, which we use to scrub out the carbon dioxide out of the air. I just tuck my feet down into the little troughs where we stored those canisters, and I can kind of lock myself in as long as I want to be latched down. And when you get ready to float free, well, that's all you have to do is float free. It's simply a delight to work in.
We had suction cup shoes, and this is an exercise where they just guaranteed us that you'd need suction cup shoes to put that big door down and close it. But you can see Crip is not even wearing any shoes. And this next thing, if we can bottle it and ship it back to Earth, we'll make $1 million. This is just delightful, going from the mid-deck to the flight deck. Just wonderful. You can see our ladder over there on the left. We didn't need that the whole flight.
We ended up in an orbit that's about 146 nautical miles, about 170 statute. And it's fantastic what you can pick up with the eyeball with respect to three-dimensional effects, resolution. You can see cities, runways, ships, what have you. And you can also color differentiation, the colors that you can pick up, all of those we've never been able to duplicate with the film that we have on board.
You're listening to The Space Program.
Finally, at the end of 50-some-odd hours, they told us we couldn't play any longer. We had tested out all the spacecraft that we had set out to do and a few more things, and so we shut those large payload bay doors. Those are very complex mechanical devices that we've had some previous problems with mechanical devices, and John and I were somewhat concerned about that and had spent a lot of time with the engineers pre-flight, and they worked just like the engineers said they would. Closed up nice and neat, and Crippen was mighty glad to see that because John had told me I had to go outside and close them in case they didn't.
This is entry. That is a sunrise on entry at about 335,000 feet. In the real world, above and below that horizon was a beautiful pinkish red, indicative of 2,000 degrees. That film's not fast enough to catch it. In a minute here, our first roll reversal will occur at 255,000 feet at Mach 24.5, and you'll see we'll really be moving on. The next roll reversal, which we cut into right away, is at Mach 18.5. We're going to be moving over about 1,500 nautical miles of Pacific Ocean in a little less than a minute. The vehicle was flying very well in this period. I think hypersonically it's more stable than we could even have imagined. It's flying very well, and the G-forces are very low at this first part of entry. They only built up to 1.5 G's.
Range to go 410 nautical miles.
Stand by for mark on 9,700 feet per second.
Hello, Houston. Columbia's here.
Hello, Columbia. Houston's here. How do you read?
We're doing Mach 10.3 at 180 AS.
And we couldn't agree more, John. Your state vector's good. We've got good data in-house.
Okay, it looks to me like the LOVD is nominal.
Chase will be on time.
Okay.
Crossing the coastline now.
We'll show you crossing the coast now.
Yeah. Right, you can come.
Mach 7. 135,000 feet, range 221 miles.
Columbia.
Dead on the ground track.
Quiet to it.
Well, that's quiet in here, too. What a way to come to California.
We'd hit the California coast just south of San Francisco, actually over Monterey Bay, doing a little less than Mach 7. And at that time, we had a beautiful day. You could see all the way down the San Joaquin Valley to cross the Sierras and to Rogers Dry Lake bed located at Edwards, which is our intended landing site. From all standpoints, we could have actually looked out the window and flown on in. It was a beautiful day. And this shows us coming over Bakersfield, California around Mach 4, and we come across the Sierra Mountains at the area called Tehachapi, roll wings level.
And you're starting to get ammonia cooling now.
Roger, we can try.
And Columbia, you're out of 100K with positive seats. Looking good.
Ejection seats can be used now.
Beautiful.
Below 100,000.
John had taken control at about Mach 4.6 to perform the subsequent roll reversals, and then giving it back to the automatic control system, and then down at Mach 1 where we went subsonic, just about over the base at 40,000 feet, he took full control and flew it on in.
Mach 1 at 51,000 feet, range 28 miles.
Columbia, you're going subsonic now out of 50K, looking good.
Everything looking good.
You're approaching the hack now. Right on the money.
This is a chase plane join up with a television. There's Mojave River, a dry lake bed out there at Edwards. And we're probably at about 30,000 feet right now. The vehicle is flying very comfortably. It's amazing what you can do with an all-electric digital fly-by-wire flying machine. And it's flying just beautifully right now.
Columbia, you're getting ready to start the big sweeping turn into the runway.
3,000 pallet.
Roger, check.
When you put the nose somewhere, it stays there. You put the wing somewhere, it stays there. It's just phenomenal how well the vehicle flies. That's Cutty Back Lake up to the north there that we might use for some of our, if we really had an incident in missing, but we didn't need such a thing. We're about to roll out on final here at Edwards.
And we're seeing 1.3 Gs coming around the hack.
Roger that.
And turning on to final, your winds on the surface are calm.
I got away.
And the final rollout will be at about 19,000 feet above the ground. We'll be accelerating to 285 knots. At this point, the chase planes have joined up on us, and they're looking us over very carefully to see if we've had any damage on the vehicle. There was none evident.
Chase gone aboard 30,000.
All righty. Roger,
Chase. That's real good underneath. 280
knots.
Everything looks real good.
And there's the road and the railroad north of Edwards, and we're about to roll out on final here, and we're accelerating very rapidly, although this has taken quite a long time. If you look at that black spot in about the middle of the lake bed there, you can see our aim point. And leading out from that aim point is runway 23 at Edwards. It's 6 miles long.
This shows one of the chase planes that had joined up with us. John McBride's in the front seat. George Nelson's in the back, and he's actually documenting the state of the tiles on the bottom of the orbiter. We did receive a little over 300 what we call dings, impacts on the bottom of the orbiter. About 225 of those actually occurred during the ascent phase. And he did document them with the film, although there was no real damage to the bottom as far as heat was incurred, and we had planned to change out some of the tiles anyhow. John is controlling the airspeed to about 285 knots using a speed brake that we have that's part of the vertical stabilizer, a split rudder, if you will, and it was a very smooth day. There was wind gust. Wind was just as smooth and as calm as anybody could have ordered. And as we said earlier, we got about a 20-degree glide slope, and there's the aim point John talked about. Pull back on the stick a little less than 2,000 feet. The vehicle with the speed brakes in at this time accelerated to a little over 300 knots, which showed us that it actually glides a little bit better than we had anticipated. So we actually put the landing gear down a little bit earlier, although from there they come down, they pop down about 5 seconds. People thought we were a little bit too close to ground. We actually do it on airspeed, put them down about 275 versus 270. Chase planes calling out wheel height. We were shooting for 185 knots. When we called out 185, John touched it down.
Two, one, touchdown. Five, four, three, touchdown. Talk about skipper.
Now, that's not bad for a Navy pilot either. That's that was a nice, nice smooth landing, as smooth as you'll find anywhere.
Welcome home, Columbia. Beautiful, beautiful.
When the nose falls through, it falls through pretty rapidly, and we thought we were going to be eating sand there for a while. The vehicle decelerates very well without braking at all by opening the speed brakes because it has a negative angle of attack doing rollout. We didn't touch the brakes until about the last 30 seconds. The vehicle came to a stop very easily and very rapidly.
That was super.
Convoy on.
We'll stop on the Columbia.
When it came to a stop, my heart rate, which had been sitting down pretty low, I guess it started to go off scale high, which is because I was really pleased to have taken part in that little evolution, and I'm sure when we got that vehicle stopped, I was mighty proud that the vehicle had worked so well.
I should point out that this vehicle has a cargo bay that is 60 feet long, 15 feet wide, and it will carry up to 64,000 pounds. That's a little bit hard for people to put in context. It's kind of like if you could put a large railroad tank car in there or a couple of buses. It's not a small vehicle. It is a very large vehicle. And it can carry it up into low Earth orbit. Now, when I say low Earth orbit, I'm talking about, well, normally somewhere in the area of like 300 miles up. If we do things just right, we can possibly get up to like 600 miles. But it is not designed to go to the moon, not designed to go to the Mars or the stars, although it is the vehicle that is eventually going to allow us to get there. such vehicles that allow us to travel out beyond low Earth orbit are going to be vehicles that the shuttle takes up and puts together in space and that are more efficiently designed to travel onto the stars.
Houston, Columbia 18 shutdown is complete. Going on the doors.
There it is, sitting there on the lake bed. It weighs 99 tons. And if you look at it, NASA says it's a DC-9, but what it really is a DC-9 with a DC-10 fuselage plug in it for big payloads. I wish I could claim we tried to stop it in this square right here, but actually we're trying to save the brakes for the next bunch.
I guess in conclusion, one of the things that I would like to try to emphasize is what a benign environment that flight really was. It was a very nice ride, one that will be able to take satellites up that have not been designed to undergo high vibrational or acceleration loads. We'll be able to take so-called people off the street that hadn't undergone some of this so-called vigorous training that John and I are supposed to have undergone. And we have a delightful flying vehicle. It is really good, a dream to operate, and we will be operating it many more times in the future. We've got a vehicle, the first one, the Columbia, each of which is going to be built or spec'd for 100 flights. Right now, we have three more vehicles coming down the line. Out in Palmdale, California, even at this time, they're putting together a vehicle that we're going to call the Challenger. Right behind it, we've got Discovery and Atlantis. And we at NASA are thinking that we need at least a fifth one. And John and I have got names for lots more if they'll just build them for us. That each of those vehicles being capable of 100 flights, like John says, if we can get the fifth one, that's talking about 500 flights. We booked up this vehicle already for 60 flights into the future. We're hoping over the next three-year period to do like 34. That's talking about at least one a month. Now it's going to get closer. Our spec turnaround time, which we hope to prove, is going to be like 2 weeks. And that's why John, as head of the astronaut office, needs like 80 pilots right now. There's lots of flying that we can foresee in the future, and we think that the potential that is offered by getting into space easily and economically is going to induce more flights that we can't even imagine right now. We appreciate your attention. Thank you very much.
The first flight of Space Shuttle Columbia, as narrated by John Young and Robert Crippen. This is Rich Kirshner reporting.
From the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, and God bless all of you on the good Earth.
This has been The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.